Well, good evening. I ask you to open your Bibles tonight, book of Daniel, chapter 6. Going to be reading from Daniel, chapter 6 tonight. We're going to talk about that story that we find there. Glad to see you while you're finding Daniel 6. Let me express my appreciation for the encouragement you've given me tonight by being here and by worshiping God and by being willing to listen to a portion of His Word for the time that we have here tonight. We have visitors here, and that's exciting as well. We're glad that you are here. If you've never been here before, we don't want this to be your last time. Please do stick around, talk to us, share a little bit about what brought you our way, what we can do for you. But we are glad that you are here this evening. Book of Daniel, chapter 6. This is a familiar story to many of us. That's what makes it fun to go back and to talk about it, because this is one of those stories that is one of the most famous stories in all the Bible. It's certainly a story that children hear a lot. It's a popular feature in a lot of children's Bible classes, VBSs, things like that. But the trick with stories that stereotypically become children's stories, if you will, in the Bible, is that we lose the adult aspect of them, the profound and powerful aspect in which these stories speak to us as well. Daniel chapter 6 is one of those stories. I ask you to follow along in your Bible with me this evening. Let's begin by reading this familiar tale. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps, because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. So the commissioners and the satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Then these men said, "We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." And then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows: "King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects, the satraps, the high officials, the governors, all of us have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked." Therefore, King Darius signed the document that is the injunction. Now, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now, in the roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. And then they approached and they spoke before the king about the king's injunction. "Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den?" And the king replied, "The statement is true, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked." Then they answered and spoke before the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah," make sure you know who he is, king, "pays no attention to you or to the injunction which you sign, but keeps making his petition 3 times a day." Then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, "Recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed." And so the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. And the king spoke, and the king said to Daniel, "Your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you." And the stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet rings of his nobles, so that nothing would be changed in regard to Daniel. And then the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting. And no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. And so the king arose at dawn, at the break of day, and went in haste to the lion's den the next morning. And when he had come near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel spoke to the king and said, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also towards you, O king. I have committed no crime. And so the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. And so Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. So then the king gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them and their children and their wives into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then Darius the king wrote to all the people, nations of every language who were living in the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and he rescues and he performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. And so this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. All right. That's a familiar story that I think many of us have heard since our childhood even. Of course, a childhood version is usually pretty benign. You know, you have children, you go through like a young child's baby Bible or something like that. The pictures are always cute, and it's like Daniel falling into a basket of kittens and nothing very violent or risky about this at all. This is a remarkable story for a number of things. And even that simplistic child's picture that takes away all the fear and all the danger and all the risk in this story really kind of reminds us of how much we have learned to see this story through benign eyes rather than the trial of faith that it really is. And so what happens here in Daniel chapter 6, if we can fill in a little bit behind the story, what's happening here in Daniel chapter 6 is, in Daniel chapter 5, the page before, the Babylonian Empire has just fallen. Now, Daniel and his three friends, remember his three friends, their Jewish names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, better known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel and his three friends have basically spent their entire lives in Babylonian captivity. They are taken captive by Babylon in 605. In 605 BC is when they are taken captive by Babylon and taken to Babylon and re-educated as Babylonian citizens so that they can serve in the Babylonian Empire. And they do. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in particular have come close to dying before when Nebuchadnezzar had ill-advised plan that everybody had to worship his golden statue. But the bottom line is, this story is taking place sometime in the 530s because now the Persians are in charge. What that means, ladies and gentlemen, what that means is that Daniel is not a young man. Kids' Bible class pictures sometimes, you know, Daniel's depicted as a young guy or, you know, kids' Bible books, stuff like that. This young boy, to make it relatable, the reality is Daniel has been in captivity for nearly 70 years, which means that if we just assume he must have been a teenager, let's say 15 when he's taken captive, this is a man who's now in his 80s. He's an old man who's been serving loyally the Babylonian regime for years, for decades. Now, what's interesting about that is this. Usually what happens in the ancient world, what happens in the ancient world when you take over an empire? Well, what's typically going to happen is you're going to destroy, you're going to remove, and usually annihilate, assassinate, destroy, kill the previous regime. Not just the king, Belshazzar, that very night is killed. Daniel chapter 5 says, but usually in the ancient world, you would also slaughter the nobles and the families, basically anybody who could lead resistance or keep Babylonian memory alive or lead a coup against you or anything like that. You would destroy the previous administration as well. We still see this in our country in a more peaceful way, don't we? When presidents change, what happens in Washington, D.C.? Do all the top jobs stay the same? Not at all. Why not? Because the new president wants his people in those positions of power. Listen, we just do it peacefully without bloodshed now. We respect the results of elections. In the ancient world, they changed at the top too when regimes changed. It was just bloody and it was ugly. What's remarkable about this story is this. And one says, here's the problem, here's the challenge. The Medes and Persians do their work. They come and they take over Babylon. They are conquerors. And yet, what do the Medo-Persian rulers do? And Daniel, they pick a holdover from the last regime and the last empire. That's fascinating. That's fascinating. That the leaders of the Medo-Persian Empire are putting in a position of great power. In fact, the king make Daniel the ruler over all other nobles under him. They pick a holdover, not just from the last regime, but they pick somebody that, and I don't think they were being nice when they said in verse 11, that Daniel is one of the exiles of Judah. He's not even Babylonian. He's a holdover of a holdover. He's an old man. He's nobody. You realize who you're dealing with, O king? So Darius picks a holdover from the last regime, the last empire. He picks somebody who was a captive of the last regime. He picks a Jew of all things. This does not sit well with those who are jealous of Daniel. But yet here's Daniel. Here's Daniel who has lived so well and so capably and for so long. And despite his origin and despite his age, Darius is prepared to put him over everything. Because one of the things the text says that Darius knows about Daniel is that he's trustworthy with money and he won't be part of a coup, basically. He's trustworthy, he's dependable, he's reliable, he's loyal. Here's Daniel who has lived so well for so long. Normally, again, when you take over an empire, you get rid of the previous leadership and their families. No revolts, no coups. But here's Daniel who technically, by the way, what's really interesting is technically, per chapter 5, technically when Babylon falls, technically Daniel is the third ruler of the empire. Remember, that's what Belshazzar offers him. If you interpret this handwriting on the wall for me, I'll make you third ruler of Babylon. Those are the type of guys you take out when you take over a country. But here's Daniel, whose reputation by that point has probably preceded them. Here's a guy who's got knowledge. Here's a guy who's got a track record of wise decisions and judgment. Here's a guy who's known to have a divine connection. He interprets dreams. He reads strange, miraculous writing left on walls in the middle of the night. Here's a guy with a divine connection. That makes him useful. And besides, rumor has it these Jews are hard to kill anyways. Nebuchadnezzar tried with fire. It didn't work. He's not Babylonian in one sense, so maybe that's why Darius trusts him. Yeah, he's Jewish. That's the whole point, is he's got no country to go home to in one sense. His country's been annihilated for 70 years now. That'll maybe make him more likely to be loyal. He's got nowhere else to go and nothing else to do. He served under several different Babylonian kings. We forget that sometimes. Nebuchadnezzar died in the 560s. Daniel's actually been loyal to a long line of Babylonian rulers by that point as the decades went by. He's been loyal not just to a particular country. He's been loyal to each man that he has served. And so they look for dirt on Daniel. But there's nothing. There's nothing against this guy that they can find. Can you imagine in this day and age, 70 years of public service? And no scandals, no mistresses, no illegitimate children, no bad press, no PR blunders, let alone no cronyism, no embezzlement, no financial shenanigans. 70 years of public service nearly on Daniel's part, and nothing can be found on him. And they admit as much. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? Because I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, then just like now, think about our own modern politics. I don't care which party's in power in Washington. Think about our own modern politics. When you get intelligent, well-connected people with resources at their disposal, they can almost always find some issue, some youthful indiscretion, some moment of weakness, some skeleton in the closet when they go to look at somebody's life and how they've lived. Listen, let's be honest. How many of us would pass that kind of scrutiny if our lives were being examined by our enemies for something that could lead to our undoing? In our media-saturated culture with its 24/7 news cycle, we routinely discover in our country that our leaders have issues. All sorts of issues. Sexual indiscretions, financial misdeeds, bad political calculations in the past, betrayed loyalties, dealings with other countries. I mean, just whatever it may be. We routinely discover our leaders have issues, moral, financial, legal. But here, Daniel. Daniel has lived a life that could pass the strictest and most intense scrutiny by those at the highest levels of power with all manner of resources at their disposal. And so they can't get him politically. They can't get him morally. What do you do? They get them religiously. And there's a lesson for us in that, ladies and gentlemen, that even when you live an upright life, and we see this more and more, I think, in our age, and we will see this more and more in our age and our time, which is that even when you live an upright, morally upright life, people will resent you, if nothing else, because of your religion, and your religion can be used against you. And so to decide to use Daniel's religion as a wedge issue. They know they will find nothing against him unless it is in regard to the law of his God. He's lived so well for so long. No disloyalty, no rebellion, no slander, no intern scandal, no sexual faux pas. There is nothing for Daniel to hide. And part of the issue, he won't even hide his religion. His life is truly an open book. Ladies and gentlemen, you and I, we've got to learn to live a lifestyle that demands an explanation, where in one sense, if somebody wants to do me harm, the only way they can do it is by holding the fact that I serve God against me. We have to learn to live a lifestyle that demands an explanation. When other people turn the bright lights of the most severe scrutiny on our lives, the only thing they can hold against us should be that we serve a different God and do not live as they do in the world. That we live by a different code than the rest of the world. When they turn the brightest lights of the strictest scrutiny on our lives, they should see no corruption, no negligence, no fudging in the files, no padding estimates, no customers overcharged or treated unfairly, no work materials or equipment missing, no neighbors who have complaints. They should find nothing against us but the fact that we serve God and do not live morally as they do. The only explanation, the only fault they can find with Daniel is he serves the wrong kind of God and lives the wrong kind of way. You need to understand, ladies and gentlemen, that when nothing else can be found against us, the political and the social order will hold our loyalty to God against us. It's as Peter put it 500, 600 years after Daniel, when he in 1 Peter 4 talked about how the world will think it's strange that you do not participate with them, that you do not run to the same excess as they do. They will think you, at best, strange. And at worst, they'll think there's something wrong with you that you should be punished for because you do not live as they do and act as they act. And so here's Daniel, an old man at this point, who's never blamed God or become bitter, that he spent his entire adult life as a captive, living at the sole discretion of a monarch who went insane for a while when Nebuchadnezzar lost his mind. Remember when God punished him? And yet that's the guy Daniel answers to. Vulnerable in his life to all the destructive pettiness of politics, just like this story. Subject to forces outside his control. Kingdoms rise, kingdoms fall. He has no say or control over that. And in one sense, never delivered from captivity, never delivered from Babylon, never delivered from living in that world to go home, never delivered by God, whom he served so faithfully and represented to the powers of this world so well. Daniel never turns on God, becomes bitter with God for the life that he has to live, the captivity, the danger, the risk, the instability of it all. If anything, he holds on to God all the more, and that's what they turn against him. So a plot is hatched. And so a plot is hatched. A decree, the nobles convince the king by playing off his vanity to issue a decree that cannot be altered, cannot be repealed. Politically, it makes sense. We're relatively new in power here, so let's use religion, as is so often, let's use religion for political purposes. And basically, all prayer and petition and entreaties needs to be offered to you as a way of political solidarity. Only prayer and praise of the new rulers for the next 30 days. And again, look at the text. Look at it carefully. Look at it carefully there. When they come to the king, verses 6 and 7 and 8, when they come to the king, all the commissioners of the kingdom, O king, the prefects, the satraps, high officials, governors, we've all consulted together, and we want it to be all about you for the next 30 days, O king. That's how you manipulate somebody. That's how you butter them up. We all agree that everything should be about you. All prayers, petition, all worship, all praise should be about you for the next month. We all agree. But this would be great. What a better way, what better way could there be to unify the new country around saluting and worshiping you? That's what totalitarian regimes do, don't they, ladies and gentlemen? The cult of the dear leader. Everybody pay attention to that great king, that great leader. And so they stroke his vanity. They play to his ego. And who knows, maybe even Darius, not knowing Daniel well, maybe when they say all agree, we're all on board with this, maybe he just assumed Daniel was on board too. He's a new ruler, doesn't know Daniel, doesn't know him well, doesn't know Daniel's God and Daniel's religion that well, and that God and that religion tolerate no other gods before me. Whatever the reason, most likely the vanity, he goes with it. Because the world doesn't know the Bible, the world doesn't know what we believe, it doesn't know the details. But they can tell conduct, they can recognize your life for what it is or what it isn't. Now what's stunning about the text is that it says that Daniel knew the decree. He knew that this was signed. He knew what had been said. He knew what was at stake. But the text also makes clear that this is his routine. This is what he does. This is what he's been doing three times a day, his lifestyle and his habits. He prays three times a day. It's like clockwork. That's why by appointment, his enemies know when to come and catch him, because Daniel is reliable about this. He will be there. That's what he does. And so the men, they go and they find Daniel doing as he always does. And so here's the thing, though, you got to understand in one very real sense. Daniel's at home. Daniel's not making a public spectacle of this. He didn't make this an issue of contrary behavior. This is not a political protest. He does not go out in the public square and say, the king is wrong, and let me pray to my God anyways. He goes home and he just does what he always does. Ladies and gentlemen, God doesn't always expect us to get involved in a way that is public, a public spectacle. He just expects us to be faithful in our lives and go about our daily business. Daniel goes home, and Daniel does what he always does. He prays to his God three times a day. His enemies are just so against him and hate him so greatly that they have to go out of their way to make an appointment to go to Daniel's house and catch him in the act as he's praying at home in his own, in the privacy of his own home. Because at the end of the day, in one very real sense, Daniel is still, as an old man in his 80s, still being faithful to the choice he made back at the beginning of his story, back in Daniel chapter 1, when he couldn't have been much more than a teenager. Young people, are you listening? Not much more than a teenager when the text says in Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8 that Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself. The Hebrew text is even stronger. Daniel set his heart. His mind, his will, his affections, all of it. He set his heart that this is the kind of life he's going to live no matter what. And that commitment he made when he was just a teenager is still the commitment he's living by as an old man in his 80s. So Daniel is read it out to the ruler. Daniel is read it out to the ruler. And again, notice how Daniel is described to the ruler. After his decades of impeccable loyalty to various kings and empires, his faithful service is impeached. It counts for nothing. Daniel's a sinister threat to the empire because he won't pray to you, O king. Decades of public service can't prove any disloyalty or embezzlement, financial shenanigans, anything. But you know what? Because he won't pray to you. He's a threat to the empire. Away with him. Away with him. And oh, by the way, he's just a Jewish captive anyways. And so the king makes every legal effort to find a loophole for Daniel, but it can't be done in their legal system. It can't be done. You know, you wonder what kind of ideas must have gone through the king's head. Do we just overfeed the lions tonight before we throw Daniel in there? Throw some drugs in there? The problem is, again, in the larger political world of the ancient Near East, the whole point of this exercise of everybody praying and petitioning the king is to build political loyalty, to build political stability in a new regime, in a new empire. And so the last thing the king can do is welch on this commitment that he has made. The law cannot be changed. Anything that he does, short of throwing Daniel in the lion's den, would undermine his authority and his legitimacy, which is political suicide. You can't show weakness just as you're beginning to occupy a new country and a new territory. Which makes it all the more stunning what the king says to Daniel. I know your God will protect you. I know your God will protect you. You worship him continually, Daniel. You pray to him regularly. I know about your lifestyle. Even the king is aware of the lifestyle this Daniel leads. And Daniel, even though your God is not my God, I believe your God will save you. And so the ruler was concerned all night long. The text in the details and the way it piles it up, he couldn't sleep that night. He's awake first thing in the morning. He makes haste back to the lion's den. He quickly goes back the next morning because he loves Daniel. He knows this is wrong. Daniel has done no wrong. And so he issues the early morning anguish call to Daniel. Calls him servant of the living God. What a confession for that king to make in a polytheistic society. Think about that for a second. And the world in which he has grown up worshiping all kinds of gods of different peoples and different places. He's a pagan. He's a polytheist. And yet, in that moment, that morning, Daniel, servant of the living God. Let me ask you something tonight. How would you have responded if you were Daniel in that moment? How would you have responded? Would you pause or wait, make him suffer a little bit? Live with the agony of a little bit longer? Build the guilty suspense, make him feel bad about what he's done? Instead, Daniel greets him with a respectful response. It's stunning, isn't it? Verse 21, Daniel spoke to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him. And also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime." Nothing but respect. He's been wrongfully accused. His life, they were trying to kill him. Don't ever forget that. They were trying to kill him. How would you or I respond in that situation in contrast to Daniel's model of faithful, humble dignity? Let's be honest, some of us would be angry. Some of us would be angry. Some of us would have our sense of righteous indignation inflamed. Wreck my reputation, will you? Decades of loyal service to the company, and this is how you treat me? Listen to lies about me, and then throw me to the lions? No, listen, King, it's too late for I'm sorries. My God trumps you, and look at that. I'm still standing here this morning. Too late for I'm sorries, O King. In fact, why don't you come on down here? I got something I want you to pet. No, see, that's not Daniel, is it? Daniel's lifestyle, ladies and gentlemen, this is what you and I need to learn and draw into ourselves. Daniel's lifestyle allows him to transcend that moment of great injustice. He transcends it. He moves beyond it. He uses the proper protocol to the king. Oh, king, live forever. That's the right way you spoke to that man in that position in that time. From the bottom of the lion's den, he responds with the same language that he would have responded on any other day. Think about that. This is an integrity that we've got to pursue in our own lives. The outcome of Daniel's faithfulness before, during, and after the lion's den incident is that once again in the book of Daniel, God is confessed and God is glorified among the nations because of Daniel, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego before him. These four Jewish men's faithful presentation of God and God's values to the world reaches to the highest levels of human power in that time in history. And Darius, with all his theological denseness, recognizes that this God of Daniel's is a God to be known and a God to be feared. And so in verse 26, he makes a decree that all men in my kingdom are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. This is not a God to be manipulated and used for political purposes like we do with our own pagan gods, our own religion. This is a God of Daniel's. Daniel's God, this is a God to be served and feared and respected. Daniel is delivered. And once again, a pagan confesses the truth about reality and creation and humanity. Well, I've got a couple minutes left with you this evening. Let me make three quick observations in closing about how we live in this story for all its familiarity and all that we know about it. Oh, we've heard it over the years, and again, our childhood memories of this story. Let me make three quick observations about how we live in this story. Number one, this story reminds us, when we look at Daniel and his life at the old age end of his life, this story reminds us that we need to be people of substance and not just statements. We need to be people of substance and not just statements. In other words, we are not just people who confess that we serve the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that we believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, and so on and so forth, that we don't believe in instrumental music, and we go to a scriptural congregation, and we don't believe in sexual immorality or any of the other shibboleths, boxes that we check and things that we say or acknowledge that make us special and make us quote-unquote Christian. What Daniel shows us is that whether in the Old Testament being a righteous Jew, whether on this side of the cross it's being a Christian of integrity, being God's person, what does it look like in daily life? What does it look like when you're still a student? What does it look like when you're working in a dead-end job? What does it look like at home? What does it look like in the community or in the workplace? What does it look like among our own brethren? What does it look like in our neighborhoods? What does it look like in our children's sports teams? Do we live constantly with integrity? So then all the different spheres of life that we come into contact with in this fallen pagan world, even those who hate us the most, can't hold anything against us, but that person serves the living God. We need to be people of substance and not just statements. But number two, I also want us to think about this evening, that we need to realize that growth and faithfulness to God, fidelity to God, growth and fidelity to God bring greater responsibility, not retirement from God's service. Isn't it interesting that in one sense, the way the Bible tells the story, the greatest challenge that Daniel faces in his life, the greatest moment of decision that he has to make about whether he's going to live or whether he's going to die, comes not at the beginning of his story, but at the end. Think about that. Daniel was tested back in chapter 1 when he's a young man. He won't eat the king's food. He won't participate in that world. And so he puts his life at risk when he does that. And yet it all works out well in the end. It's a happy ending. And Daniel in the rest of the Babylonian era, in chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5, Daniel's never at risk again. Until you come to chapter 6, and now he's an old man. We understand, ladies and gentlemen, that despite the fact in the world, the idea is that once you've served your time or paid your dues or taken the risks, you get the reward and you get to retire. But that's not how the kingdom of God works. That's not how it works. That's not how it works with the people of God. What we do in the past, what we endure and what we faithfully overcome is preparation for future service to God and to the generations behind us, where if nothing else, we stay around to tell those younger than us and those coming behind us the truth about who God is and what he's done in our lives and what he's done in the Bible. And young people especially, you need to understand that you're on the clock now with God. You're on the clock already with God. And what you are doing now determines what God can use you for in the future. You could either, young people, be living a life that leaves all sorts of possibilities open. You could be preparing yourself to be used by God. Daniel probably thought his great challenge was when he was young in chapter 1, making a break with the diets of the Babylonians. And it only turns out that was just preparing him for an even greater challenge in an empire he hadn't even heard of yet because it didn't exist back then. We've got no idea what the future holds, folks. And young people, you especially, when all things being equal, you've got several decades of life to go yet. We've got no idea what this country's going to become, what the economy's going to become, what the politics are going to become. You've got no idea what's coming. None of us do. And therefore, it all the more behooves us now to be living in ways that are preparing us to be useful to God in whatever circumstances come. We spend so much time, young people, worried about where we're going to go to college and what we're going to major in and what our career's going to be. What do you want to be when you grow up? But moms and dads, are we talking to our kids as much about their faith in the future as we are their careers for the future? How often do we talk to our sons about being elders someday? And so therefore, when you're making a decision about who to marry, when you're making career decisions that are going to take your time away from the church and from growing in knowledge and wisdom and relationships with your brethren, are we talking to our teenagers? Talking to our 20-somethings, moms and dads, grandparents? Or is the conversation always, where do you want to go to school and what do you want to do? Growth and fidelity bring greater responsibility, not retirement in the kingdom of God. And so the question for each of us tonight is, how are you doing? How am I doing with what God has already given us? The opportunities, the position, the job, the reputation, the money, the relationships, the people he's already put in our lives. What are we doing? How are we leveraging all of that for his benefit, his purposes? Let me humbly suggest this evening that maybe the reason that sometimes we don't get what we want in life, what we think we deserve, is because we haven't lived in a way in which God thinks he can trust us with more than what we already have and what we already are and where we're already at. Because we're not always using what we've already been given for his purposes. As James puts it in James chapter 3, you ask because you want to spend it on your own selfish pleasures. And so what Daniel's story reminds us is that the greatest challenge of his life comes in retirement. When he's over the hill, past his prime, should be hanging it up, writing his memoirs, cashing in. Yet the most famous story of his life comes at the end. Number three, and finally this evening, let's also, ladies and gentlemen, this story helps us to remember that we need to admit that our comfort, our convenience, and our custom often compromise us. Say that five times real fast. Our comfort, our convenience, and our custom often compromise us. One of the greatest challenges to being faithful to God, or being more faithful, more committed to God, are the things that we don't want to lose and we don't want to give up. Especially when it comes to our time. That may be the biggest thing that we hold back from God, is our time. Let me ask you something tonight. What do you have that you do not want to lose? Because Satan probably already knows it, even if you don't want to admit it. And he may already be using that against you. There's a sense in which, while we, all of us in this country, have never had to serve God under persecution, I tend to think that serving God under persecution, going underground, would be easy compared to serving God in a culture which tempts us with all the pleasure and the freedom and the gratification that ours does. Because at least when you have to go underground, it forces you to make clarifying choices about what you're going to live your life for. The problem in our age, ladies and gentlemen, is that our comfort and our convenience and our custom tempt us and blind us and desensitize us to the idea that we can have both the world and God, even though Jesus says that cannot be done. And so here in the book of Daniel is a gray-headed man who is so committed to God that even in his 80s, he won't take a 30-day hiatus from praying at the risk of his life and his position and his reputation and everything that he has accomplished in decades of public service at the highest levels of global empires. Think about that. You ever had your boss push you? It's just for a week. It's just this one time. Daniel, I just need you to take a break for 30 days, man. That's all I'm asking. 30 days. We got a new kingdom. It's a new startup here we got going on. I just need 30 days. And you can go back to doing what you do, and that's fine. Daniel will not take a 30-day hiatus from prayer at the risk of his life. And yet, let's be honest, if we look at ourselves, we tend to forsake God for what sometimes? A little more sleep, a sporting event, a little more money, a little more pleasure. On the other side, let's be clear as well. It's not just being faithful at worship services and Bible classes, as important as those things are. It's not just what you do here at the building for a couple hours a week. It's about who you are on Tuesday and Thursday. Young people, it's about whether you wake up on Saturday morning with regrets for what happened on Friday night. Too often we sit there and say, I don't have time for more Bible reading, more study, more reflection, more prayer myself because of what, work? School? Too many activities? Because when we come home, I just need to relax. The TV helps me do that. It wasn't worth it to Daniel. It wasn't worth it to Daniel. Not 30 days off. Not at the risk of everything. Because there was nothing to Daniel. Nothing more important. and being a man of integrity and living in relationship with his God. May God help us to be those kind of people. May we look back to that old familiar story. Can we bring it up into adulthood and not just leave it in our childish past? This is a story for grown-ups. It's a story that challenges us about who we are and what we want to be. With the utmost test, what would your enemies say about you? And what would God say about you? Because those are the real tests, not what I think about myself, but what do others know about me, even the strictest and brightest of scrutinies. And will I choose God no matter what? If you're here thinking you need to choose God, we want to help you with that. If you've never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, but you're in a position tonight to know what the Lord expects of you, and you would like our help in obeying that, and you're ready to confess Jesus as Lord, Savior, Son of God, repenting of your sins, and being baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, we'll help you with that this evening. If you're here tonight, you're a child of God already, however, but you have lost the faith of Daniel. You're compromised in some way. It wouldn't take much for somebody to be able to say something about who you are and how you're living. Pray to God for forgiveness of that tonight. Come back to God. Get faithful again. We can pray with you for you in some way. We can hold you accountable. Listen, that's what the church is for. We're here to help each other and talk to each other and teach each other and pray for each other. And if we can do that for you, why don't you come talk to us right now while we stand, while we sing.